Fight Club. We are joined today, of course, by Mr. Rob Stone. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm excited for this. This will be good.
Lots of
interesting points either way. So all good.
For sure. We've got Billy Sven back on. So welcome back to the show and glad to have you back again.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for coming on and for providing a nice topic of discussion today that we'll get into here in a bit. But how's life treating y'all?
Pretty good. Nothing to complain about.
Yeah. I just got back from a work trip to D.C. Yesterday, so I had to swing. After we flew back, I swung by little spot to try my hand, see if I could flip a milk snake, but not that lucky. I think it's a little early in the year. So, but I thought, it's like 60 degrees and maybe something would be under a rock, but I think the nighttime lows are still a little low. So we'll see. It was worth a shot, but I did see a beautiful Western skink, which this bright blue tail, but then like a stupid large ape, I tried to grab it and knocked his beautiful blue tail off. I felt terrible. I don't know why I think of these things afterwards, but I should have gotten a video of it. And then I probably could have pulled a picture from the video, you know, and done a screenshot or something. So not the brightest thing, but I just got really excited to see something moving, you know, first herp of the season, I think. Well, no, I guess I saw some in Arizona, a couple little lizards, but so first Utah herp, I guess I should say. But it was a nice little detour. I was out in the middle of nowhere, seemed kind of out in the West Desert looking around. So I found a couple spots on Google Earth that I wanted to check out. So they looked right, you know, I looked pretty good. So hopefully they'll be fruitful when the time is right. But I was going to go up in the mountains, but we got dumped on with snow. So I figured that wouldn't be very productive either. So I stuck to the lowlands, which was a little bit of a further trip, but I got back at like noon, so I had a few hours to kill. So figured traveling, you know, counts as work time. So but yeah, it was a nice time to get out in the field, go flip some rocks. But man, my forearms and the back of my thighs are really sore from bending over and lifting rocks for couple hours there. Need to get into some shape. I need to start lifting weights to prepare to lift rocks. Not just have
right. We'll see how it goes in SoCal at the end of the month with Eric and Brandon and Dustin, and at least we have their youth and enthusiasm to help with that. Maybe it's the next day that'll be tough with being sore, but
yeah. Nice. Yeah, I'm excited. I wish I could make it to this one, but yeah, I've just been got too many trips planned, I guess. I'm gearing up, getting excited. I just made kind of the final reservations for the trip over in Australia, getting all the stuff packed in for cans, trying to show the two youngest girls some fun stuff over there. Booked a crocodile tour, so we're going to go on the Daintree and look at crocs with the Solar Whispers. That one was recommended. So we'll see.
It's a good Instagram account at a minimum, right? Yeah. And maybe that's the one. We had stopped in at one of those places, but we didn't go on the tour when we'd gone there the first time. But yeah, I know certainly the Instagram for that looks pretty good. Seems like they go, you know them really well, which is obviously one of the huge benefits of that. And other things that to spot along the way or where it likes to hide out and all that. So
yeah. And those tours, I mean, when they go out, you know, several times a day, they kind of see stuff and kind of know where stuff is. Although we're going on the first hour of the day, you know, the first trip of the day, but it's at 9:30. So it's like 3 hours after sunrise. So hopefully it'll be warm enough that they're out basking and that kind of thing. So I was talking with Matt Somerville, cause he works at Hartley's, and I was thinking, we'll just go to Hartley's and maybe meet Matt and go see some crocs. But he's like, they're all just kind of captives in a lagoon. You know, they're not true wild crocs. So he's like, I'd recommend that one. So hope I don't get him in trouble with his work. But he said that would be if you want to see wild crocs, that's the place to do it. So we'll see how that goes. But he also said go in the morning. So yeah, that's when they're kind of out and basking and things. So yeah, excited to get back out there. We're going to go kind of a loop. So we'll start in Cairns. We'll hit, you know, the, that was another, some other good advice from Matt was to, you know, I was kind of debating between two different islands. One was larger and had, you know, goannas and stuff on the island. And I was thinking, oh, that'd be kind of cool. But he said the sea life there is not great. There's not much reef. And so we're going to go to Green Island, which is the one I took the older siblings on. So the younger siblings will have some, you know, notes to share with their older sisters and brothers. So that'll be fun for them, I think. And then we're going to do kind of a loop over into the Tablelands and, you know, up to Daintree over in the Tablelands and then down maybe over to Eddie Beach. I think my youngest wants to go look for cassowaries. So we're going to go down, you know, see if we can find.
Well, Caranda, right? That's where ours was. I know you had the one on the beach, which is a cool look for sure. But,
I think, as far as I've, you know, read, it seems like Eddie Beach is like the most reliable place to see him. I mean, we'll be looking for him on the whole trip. So I guess if we see one somewhere else, we won't necessarily drive all the way down there, but just trying to, I don't know. It's hard with teenagers getting, you know, what do you want to do over there? And it's not like they're doing the research or something. So it's like, I have to give them a bunch of options and see what they want to do, but we'll definitely be doing some night herping. Hopefully they won't chicken out too early. I know we went to the curtain fig and we were looking, you know, for geckos and something, but they heard like a tree kangaroo rustling above them. And they're like, what's that, Dad? We got to get out of here. This is too spooky. I'm like, it's probably a big tree kangaroo. It's not that big of a deal. But they also had kind of crappy headlamps, so that might have added to their anxiety of being out in the night. So we'll have much better headlamps this time around.
Won't pull a Nick and not bring one at all, hey?
No. And we won't be eating many noodles either, I don't think. Maybe the occasional.
What kind of trip even is that?
Right? Among other things, I suppose. But yeah. And no show Fair muscles. Enough. I'm going to be lifting rocks. well, yeah, I'm still waiting on that black-headed python female to lay. And this is kind of late for her. She usually lays a little earlier, so maybe that means she'll cook them a little better. We'll have a better hatch rate. We'll see how that goes. And got another woma ready to lay, a couple pygmy pythons that should be laying as well, a couple other antaresia. But yeah, they're looking like they're progressing well, but still no eggs, so we'll see how that goes. Always the waiting game, right? I don't know. You guys, how's your herp collections doing? Any exciting jumps forward?
I have a pretty small group that I manage, but my dendrobate, the yellow and black poison frogs, I got the first eggs from them for the season just yesterday. So that was fun. Last year was their first year breeding, and they made a few eggs that were duds, but eight froglets came out of it, and this first clutch of eggs was 11 eggs. So off to a strong start for the year, so we'll see how that goes. At Tinley, I picked up some Phyllobates terribilis orange blackfoot, and then I made a custom enclosure with all native plants, so like a biotope of the Choco rainforest.
Oh, cool.
And so starting in January or so, I got them all into that enclosure. So that's been really fun to see them. They're so bold, little bulldogs of a frog, just hopping around, begging for food. And then finally getting my cave gecko. I have it paid for, and just shipping leather is coming around here. So, maybe the next week. We'll see.
Nice. Which species?
Hiensis. So the main one, or the most common one. Right. Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. Good one to start with, I figure.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah, the Terribilis, I think, are my favorite dart frogs. Oh, I keep thinking I should get some of those, but I keep telling myself I don't want to deal with fruit flies.
Yeah.
Well, and that's those orange part. Blackfoots, man, that's a cool look.
They're so cool.
Yeah.
And I have four in there, and I can almost always see all of them. You know, they're just right there.
They're very bold.
So bold and active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you like with a dart frog for sure. You want to be able to see those flashy colors.
Yeah.
I guess when you're the most poisonous thing,
right?
Or at least one of the most poisonous things on Earth, you're going to be bold. You don't have to worry about that. Much. Hey? Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, probably an association there, as opposed to the other, you know, the little tiny Rantamaya and stuff, where it's like, yeah, they seem all, in my experience, for the most part, they're you know, pretty jumpy and reclusive, and it's like, yeah, you're probably not nearly as toxic in the wild, so.
A little better.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I guess my captive herp excitement mimics what you've been doing there, Billy, in terms of a long-running goal that has been a slightly less long project, has been trying to move my rhino rat snakes into cages that are true to biotype as well, specific to, so where we're at now basically is it's a combination of Tam Dao, what was the National Forest when they were first collected for captivity in 94, 95 by a joint Russian, Vietnamese, American scientific expedition, and then those went to both Germany and Russia, those captive animals, and Cat Ba Island, which is actually referencing the trip that Ryan and Nick and Chris took, right, that they had gone there, and so which is very much limestone karst and is the spot where most of them are seen nowadays. So the enclosure has a universal rock gray limestone background. Leaf litter is all based on plants that at a minimum exist there now. So it's got magnolia, mangosteen, jackfruit, and bamboo. Bamboo to add some additional verticality, a verticality feature. And the coolest part is I planted them with this species of Vietnamese violet that was originally collected for horticulture on a joint Soviet-Vietnamese expedition in 1988 from Tam Dao, so from the same spot that the rhinos come from. So it's right tied in there. And I tell you what, so I have six of them all good to go. I have five more to build out, but got the luminized bulbs, all this stuff going on, and it's just the joy and satisfaction of that project has been, it's been a long, long time since I've been as happy about a captive herp project as that.
That's very
set up
cool.
Really, you know, they took to it seemingly right away. And then the next day I was like, okay, well, now it comes time to pair them up. And I, with three of the six, I put in males, and sure enough, within an hour, they're locking up and doing the stuff. So, it's been fantastic.
Very cool.
That's awesome. That sounds really awesome.
I was going to ask you, you sent a picture around in one of our message boards and had a female kind of in a tunnel or a,
So the one
that, or how does that
work? No, so the one non-unique feature to it is, or non geographically appropriate. I love cork bark, but in this context I didn't want cork bark visible in the enclosure, so essentially I used it as a buttress for an underground to go underneath. There's a little bit of substrate underneath it, slab of cork bark, and then there's more substrate on top, and then the leaf litter on top of that, so it kind of functions as a
height area,
subterranean height area or whatever. But and all of them went right to it on the first day like it was nothing weird, coming from, however, they're basically now all of those, I think, save all the ones that went into those cages I've produced myself. So I've had them their whole time, and they certainly know and utilize cork bark. So that wasn't that weird. It was just under a little bit of dirt.
That's cool. In the wild, are they also hanging out underneath, rocks?
Yeah, so that's been interesting. I think the, one thing would be, so on Cat Ba, as I say, that's like more than half of the records on iNaturalist are from there at this point. And you kind of see them, I think half of those records are basically on the road. So obviously mm-hmm. that's not their natural habitat. They're going through someplace. Then there's some that are swimming in the big lakes. There's some that are on the beach on little sticks. I think basically, and this would correspond to my captive experience with them, is they're basically all-terrain snakes, so that they're capable of climbing, but they're not arboreal in the sense of being, you know, strictly arboreal manifest to that point. I think they, for the most part, utilize basically every aspect of where they are. I don't think they're limited in any way. So, and that's the experience I've seen with them over the week or so that they've been set up that way, is part of the day they're underground, part of the day they're basking at elevation. Other times they're lying amongst the leaf litter. Some of them like to sleep amongst the leaf litter. Some of them sleep perched, and some sleep underground under the in the little buttressed cave. So, yeah, all-terrain snakes for sure.
That's interesting. Any idea what kind of function the horn serves naturally? I mean, that just seems like something a tree, you know, snake would have, or something to kind of mimic a leaf or pointy stick or something. But
I think it probably breaks up their form. So it's not hard, right? It's pliable. And the one sort of challenge, right, in transitioning some things that have been in tubs or in cages that have like papered over fronts or, you know, semi-opaque fronts, is sure enough, I put them in there and they spent the whole time sort of exploring. Whoa, there's a lack of a visual barrier here. So in response, I put some books on the edges, particularly for the ones that were, really, they show seemingly no care to just, you know, mashing it into things. And I don't love, they were, you know, they're all objectively fine, but it was one of these, I don't want this to be I don't necessarily want the learning curve to turn into taking a shed to heal or anything like that. So I had put visual barriers there, and then that stopped it. They responded to that, presumably over time. They haven't done it to the front, so I don't think I think I can probably eventually wean them off of that. But as they get used to it, but it's not surprising, right? They've spent between 5 and 10 years not living in a clear box, so that's not all that surprising, right?
Yeah.
And but to your point, right? They're just mashing it around and stuff. They really don't show any hesitation to do that. I think from my perspective, it's both breaking up their form when they're in a tree, and I think it probably breaks up their form when they're little and they're trying to feed in the water, right? And so when they're little, they're little gray worms basically, and maybe it's and they're feeding on fish and tadpoles, and that if they're putting their head in the water, that it's not as noticeably a snake if it's got that projection coming off the front. That being said, I mean, functionally, they, to me, they're essentially the same physiologically. They're different in terms of their attitude, feeding habits and things to the Chinese rain snake, R-E-I-N snake, now Ganyosoma frenatum. To me, should be Rhynchophis boulangeri and frenatum in the same genus, because functionally, their eye shape is a little bit different. Their body structure is slightly different. But functionally, if boulangeri didn't have a horn, they're almost, meaning unless you have a very practiced eye, you couldn't tell them apart from a frenatum.
Okay.
So there's a snake that lives in the same place, or they overlap. They're both of them at Tam Dao, where, you know, they overlap, but they both exist. So there has to be some benefit to have caused it to be that trait to be maintained, right? Otherwise, they'd just be out-selected, presuming there's some cost to forming it.
Sure. That's cool. And have you ever kept the other species?
I have. They tend to be much much more irascible and don't feed as well, generally. Don't start as well. They both are born, as I say, gray worms with sort of the rhinos, it's more like black and white inclusions, whereas most frenatum have it's more like brown and a little bit of yellow, less white. Some you can have a little bit of white, but that yellow look to them on the dorsal surface is something you don't really see in the rhinos.
Yeah.
But well, and they're far less popular. Actually, the most recent colubrid and colubroid,
yeah.
I think it was the most recent, they talked about frenatum a fair bit. Or no, I apologize. I had gotten confused thinking Matt Most. But it was the Snakes and Stowies 200 when Matt was on there. They were talking about frenatum a little bit. And I think there is somebody who I'd talk to who is really into them, but they've never been nearly as popular, never nearly had the same level of success, which is, as I said, surprising, because they're seemingly visually, functionally similar, but there's something, you know, that's causing that, presumably.
Yeah. That's that kind of, I mean, I was thinking about that, listening to that 200th episode, you know, when you lose a champion of a species, you know, sometimes those species just go away and you never see them in, or very rarely see them in captivity again. So that's a, it's good to have people that are interested in similar projects, you know, to find those like-minded souls or something. But I don't know, herpetoculture is fickle sometimes. And it's funny how everybody wants to keep the same stuff, you know, just anytime I vend a reptile show, I'm just like, you know, somebody says, oh, I usually ask them, what do you keep? And invariably it's usually ball python, boa, you know, just the same pat answers, a crested gecko, a corn snake, you know. And I guess I just like diversity or unique things or different things than everybody else has. I don't know. Kind of tricky, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think half the fun is, you know, we have a group of folks we go on trips with, right, and all that. And for the most part, or in large part, we keep different things. And I think that makes a ton of sense, both in terms of, you know, it's cool to go to your place and see stuff that I don't have. You know, what fun would it be if we just all had the same things? Right. And I think there really is something to, there are things that will work well with the way you keep animals in the space that you have in your area that almost certainly won't be this, you know, between you and I, they might be pretty similar, but between Billy, myself, and yourself, there almost certainly are conditions, are underlying conditions before you even get into how often we, what we think of feeding and light cycling, all these different things, what externalities we're going to apply before you even get into that, our space is going to be different, right? Yeah. And almost certainly that's going to be suited to different things. The Colorado chondro thing always surprises me because our, same as you, relative ambient humidity doesn't really seem to associate particularly well with that. I guess you get the benefit if you're putting in the externality, you know, if you're adding, then at least you can naturally go dry, which has its purpose in terms of a cycle effect on them. But, you know, it's kind of a weird, an unusual thing, right, that you would think, and probably has more to do with Bushmaster than it does anything else.
True.
I think the same way Maryland being a hotbed, you know, relative to the National Zoo and Trooper and all that stuff. So that it's those sort of external factors that not, it's just that our conditions are so similar that it makes them easy to keep in this area. Because I don't think so, unless you change your whole room dynamic, which is both a big project. And if anything at all goes wrong, then that can be a real problem.
Yeah. Speaking of Trooper Walsh, his influence can still be seen at the National Zoo. They have a very nice designer green tree python on exhibit there. It's got a lot of the yellow scales, you know, throughout the green and stuff. It's what's that look? What do they call that again? Where it has a lot of yellow in it in the pattern.
So the ones that were really, really yellow was the lemon tree stuff, but that's Tim Tremese, you know, from back in the late 80s, early 90s, that stuff. And then some of that was still kicking around or is mixed into things. Then there was Eugene's OS high yellow stuff. It was also, it looks quite a bit different to that lemon tree stuff. And then, you know, get a Biak in the mix and you got a shot. So.
They were definitely, well, there was just one on exhibit, but it was nice looking snake, you know, lots of white, lots of yellow, lots of green. So a couple black scales, kind of fun. But yeah, I remember, it's been many years ago. I kind of invoked Trooper Walsh's name, and I think I contacted him via email, and I said, you know, head of the National Zoo, anybody there can show me around or something. And this, I can't remember his name. I think I wrote it down somewhere, but he showed me around, like took me behind the scenes, let me even pet a Komodo dragon, which probably,
nice.
I don't know that could happen these days, but you know, that was long enough ago that they probably had a little less stringent rules back then. But yeah, it was pretty fun. Oh, and incidentally, I did a little herping in the zoo. I walked in the zoo and the first enclosure was the sloth bears. Was it the sloth bears? Yeah. And I go to put my foot up on the wall to kind of stand up and see if I could see him hiding out or something. And there was a little decay snake right by where my foot was. And so I'm like, hey, a snake. They're like, where did you get that? Did you pull that out of an enclosure? no, these guys, ranger. And then there was this family coming up and they saw me taking pictures of it. And they're like, I have a snake. And so I went over and showed it to him, let him pet it and stuff. And then released it kind of behind the wall in the keeper area and some leaf litter and just kind of let it go. But kind of cool. That was a lifer for me. I'd never seen a decayed snake in the wild.
Yeah.
So
cool.
And it was a nice looking one. It was kind of fun. So that was, my herping excitement, I guess, in DC.
Really working through your steraria, huh?
Yep. Yeah. We got the red backed, snake and
red belly, I think.
Red bellied. Yeah. And then I think those are the only, how many steraria are there?
That's what I was looking up.
Yeah. Yeah. Was the worm snake's not a steraria, is it?
I don't think so, no.
But yeah, I guess if there's only two species, then I've made my way well through the steraria.
So it looks like there's five species and a whole heck of a lot of subspecies of decays in particular. But 40%.
Pretty wide ranging. Yeah, there we go. Right on. Well, guys, ready to do a little fighting?
Yeah,
sure.
I think it's about time. So, all right. Well, I don't know if you have anything. I mean, where you've been on the show a couple times. You know, we usually have already kind of introduced themselves and where they fit into herpetoculture. I don't know if anything's changed or if you're still kind of. I don't know if you want to, you know, say just a little bit about kind of what your. I guess mindset is in regards to herpetoculture. And I mean, you've got a busy full-time job as a doctor. And so I imagine you don't have a ton of time for a big herp collection. So.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a small collection. And definitely quite tailored to be all contained within one room, which is also like my home office. So everything is, kind of like understory tropical animals, low temperature, high humidity, so that I don't need to, you know, so that I can work in here throughout the day and not get too warm. So mostly frogs, a couple of day geckos, that I've had for a number of years now that I got in medical training. That was kind of like the oddball as far as not small. I focus on trying to have some naturalistic planted enclosures, really interested in the natural history of the animals.
Very cool. Yeah. I like the, you know, the philosophies and, you know, some of your ideas and on some of the past shows. So yeah, if you guys haven't heard, Billy's previous, episodes, go back and check them out and the stuff that he shared on other podcasts as well. You were on,
Project for Petaculture somewhat early on, like in the teens, I think. Yeah. That was the first podcast I did. Definitely, our conversation about my, thoughts on why keeping and how I'm keeping things. And then I've been out here a couple times, and then I've been at the pass.
Okay.
Definitely.
Cool. Your audio's kind of a little.
Is that better?
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah, I think I was just moving away from the mic.
Yeah. There we go. All right. Well, okay. So today, so you sent an idea over messaging there and had kind of an idea to talk about whether or not we should really be pushing keeping smaller and smaller species, right? So finding alternatives for the current, you know, popular pet species. And so I think that's a great topic and we'll kind of discuss, you know, the pros and cons of kind of moving towards smaller and smaller species in herpetoculture and make a nice little fight out of that. So Rob and I will go ahead and flip the coin to see who gets to battle you today. So Rob, if you'll do the honors of calling the flip there.
Let's go heads again.
Heads. It's tails. Man, you were not having a good run at the coin toss. You need to use the Chuck method of gauging how high the flip is. And he thought he had some formula. But it started to work out for him, but I guess maybe this just isn't your year. So,
yeah, maybe so.
Well, I've got some thoughts, and I'm sure, you know, of course, Rob can chime in, but I'll go ahead and kind of take the lead there. So fight old Billy here. Okay. Cool. And then go ahead and make the other call there, Billy.
I'll go tails.
Tails. It is heads. Man, I'm a double winner again. That happened to me last time too. I will take the con. I'm going to go.
Okay.
Let's stick with some big stuff in there. So, all right.
It
well,
be big. It can just be normal size.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. We're not talking retics and Galapagos tortoises. We're just talking, trying to push into the smaller and smaller realm. So I guess I'll let you go first so you can kind of start us out. So
I like it. Yeah. So, on the side of getting smaller and smaller animals, I think the obvious big benefit of getting smaller animals is that you give them more space for less effort and resources. So if you think about keeping, for example, like a ball python in like a 4x2x2, foot enclosure that like a lot of people would say is a lot of people that would advocate for a naturalistic enclosure would say that's like what you should be keeping them in as like a minimum, whether or not that's the right way to go about that. I'm not going to pick that, but like just like arbitrarily saying that that's like a good size for a ball python. If you put an antaresia in that, you're going to have so much more space for them to move around. Like if in a 4-foot enclosure, most ball pythons can stretch out or they at least fairly well. But they're not going to actually be able to like move sequentially, you know, their whole body doesn't fit multiple times in there, but you get like an antaresia in there, let alone, I mean, now you're talking about snakes with quite a bit different, you know, ecologies, natural histories. But if you get some like a garter snake or like that little decay snake that you had, you know, and you still put it in a similar amount of space, you can now create an environment and see all kinds of different things that you wouldn't see if you had a larger animal in that enclosure. You can also like the ability to, and this is my bias in someone that likes to design complex enclosure and habitat for the animal. It's so much harder to do that for a bigger animal that can move things around, push things over so much easier. Everything needs to get braced. Even like making something, or again, my ball python, or I used to have like a bearded dragon before that, like it would knock things over. That compared to like my little day geckos, those, you know, you can essentially get like a twig that you can like really secure to the background with just a little bit of Gorilla Glue. That's not going anywhere for these little guys. And you can make like a lattice work that essentially lets them utilize almost 100% of the volume in the enclosure. And now you can see all kinds of behaviors that would be, in order to replicate that in, you know, an animal 10 times bigger than it, you would need more than a 10 times bigger enclosure, because you would need to be able to secure all those things so well. So that's my main thing. That's my main point, is that for less or even similar resources, you can make a significantly better environment for that animal to be in. That's beneficial for the animal, and then it's also beneficial for us as keepers, because we get to enjoy seeing those animals doing complex.
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely enjoy that aspect of it, you know, keeping the smaller species. And I guess, especially in regards to the complex environment, sometimes that can be a little more challenging in monitoring small species. You know, if they're in a giant enclosure and, you know, if you haven't nailed it right or something and they get kind of, you know, in an area where maybe it got too cold, or they get stuck in something or under something, you know, so you don't secure something to the floor, and it kind of, they're a little easier to damage, I guess, with their cage furniture than maybe a more robust species. But, so I guess I might counter with that, or at least caution that, you know, I remember I got a bunch of, morning geckos, and I had this nice big planted enclosure and put them in there and, you know, putting in food and that kind of thing. But it was really hard to tell if they were, you know, if they were eating enough and if they were, cause I very rarely see them because one, they're nocturnal, and this was in my office where I'm at during the day. And then, you know, two, the calcium supplementation, you know, they might not get their prey species very quickly. And so, I ended up, losing one. Found it, kind of, in the enclosure dead. And I'm like, oh man, I thought they would just thrive in this, you know, but it is a little bit harder to tell what's going on and potentially for them to secure prey and in a really well planted enclosure if they had never experienced that. You know, I imagine it'd be different if you got a wild caught, you know, lizard that's used to living in a lush tropical environment. But, so I ended up moving them into a more simplistic enclosure where I could monitor them easier. Their eggs weren't like stuck into some, you know, crack in the enclosure, making it impossible to get the eggs out of there to, you know, so the adults wouldn't eat the babies or something once they hatch out. You know, those kind of things are a lot easier in a smaller, maybe more simplistic in design.
No, definitely. I think from like a, not even really a counter argument, just like a practical example, I don't just put my animals into a complex enclosure. I usually scale them up. So like for my day geckos, they're not like, you know, the Madagascar giant day geckos, they're Lepidactylus canrawi, which is significantly smaller than even like the Williams eye. So, I mean, these geckos are, you know, body and tail fitting on my pinky finger. And so when I first got them, I had them individually in like 1 gallon, cereal boxes, like the plastic cereal boxes. So you have like a tiny little lid that you flip open. It's like really easy to access without them escaping. So I converted those similar to how you convert like a rack box, you know, but then I like added plants and stuff. So it was still somewhat complex. And then I moved them from like, I think I have 2 females. I put them into the same enclosure. That's now like a 7 or 8 gallon custom vertical build that I made. And then I still don't have the exact plans, but I eventually want to move them into a bigger one and get a male and maybe another female or something to make, something quite a bit larger that, yes, like I won't see them every day, but based on, now I know how they tend to perch and bask, and I know I can keep them quite a bit hotter than I did in their smaller enclosure because I'm noticing that they're always on the top, and so that I'm giving them more UVB, more heat, you know, with like a tiny little halogen, which have a higher wattage on it. And now they're cruising all over instead of just like always staying with the heat. So I think getting to know that style of keeping does require more attention and does require, I think, practice like leading up to the final conclusion of having them in a big complex enclosure. That being said, if you wanted to have your morning geckos in a fairly simple, plastic plant or a plant in a pot that doesn't look like naturalistic or something, and you know, some PVC tubes that are just like scattered around, you could do that in like a 10 or 20 gallon or like a smaller Exoterra compared to if you wanted to do that with like a Lichianus or a crested gecko. So regardless of what style of enclosure you want to do, and my personal preference is for these complex ones, which I want to be bigger, the smaller animal needs a smaller space.
Yeah. I, you know, I, I definitely like having, you know, more room for the animals, and I guess it depends on your goals in some ways as well. So if you're, you know, a big breeder trying to produce a lot of animals and you need low maintenance and, you know, things like that, if, or trying to have more clean environment or something, sometimes, you know, with those well-planted environments, a lot of times some of the work is spent maintaining the enclosure rather than, you know, maintaining the animal necessarily. I guess that goes hand in hand, but, so the other kind of point I wanted to make, on this topic in regards to caging is that a lot of the cages in herpetoculture are kind of designed for larger species. And so whether or not they're the right size or not, they, you know, have gaps and openings and cracks and, you know, that very small species can slip out of very easily. Now, I think, Armin's a great example from Herp Time is a great example of somebody who's kind of building an industry around these smaller species. He's done very well with those micro geckos and anoles and stuff like that. And he's also, designing his own cages. And so he'll, you know, basically sell you an animal with a cage. And so it kind of, it's a smart move, I think, on his part. And he's done a very good job of making that, very profitable, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it requires a little bit of, a little bit more thought and work, to make sure that these small little things don't just escape into your home. And that can be a huge nightmare trying to locate a micro gecko in a room with books and, you know, posters and stuff on the wall.
Oh yeah.
Like they're going to disappear pretty quickly and you'll probably find it shriveled up in a corner, you know, in a spider web or something, you know, I've had Antaresia, you know, that escaped out of holes that I thought would be too small. These baby, you know, hatchling Antaresia.
There's not holes too small.
Yeah, right. They can find a way in a lot of ways, and then, you know, inevitably a couple would not make it, and you'd find them seriously like in a spider. The spider had captured them and basically eaten them. So it's, you know, kind of not the best. I had a lot of hard lessons early on with Antaresia, you know, learning what they couldn't escape from. So
yeah, that's my first Lagodactylus escaped, through a tiny gap in the door. I think the doors, you know, had to have custom cut glass to make the pink. And I think, well, I know they weren't completely square, but they weren't completely right angles. And so if you didn't perfectly shut it, there could be a tiny little gap. So the new doors are perfect. There's like a silicone seal in between them. And then I took sponge filter foam and like used a pencil and wedged it up into like the top of the crack. So it's hard to get the doors in and out, so they can't even slide up and hide underneath there. So yes, like absolutely. If I was arguing the other side, that was high on my list on my notes was escaping, because I think that's the difference between like small and like tiny. And I kind of like the, just like, it's like a challenge for myself. How small can I go? But even like, so you take a bearded dragon and instead you get one of Phil Lee's Xenogamma, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not going to escape that much easier than a bearded dragon, but you put that in a 4x2x2, and you're going to see that thing cruise around like mad compared to what a bearded dragon would be able to do. It could like probably get full speed, you know, before it gets to the other end. And then if you didn't want to do that and you wanted to put it in a 40 gallon, that would probably be like a great life for it too. And that probably wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I'm always baffled. I'll bring a Rankin's dragon or something to the show. And
yeah, Rankin's should be so cool. Yeah.
Right. And they're like, what kind of, you know, is it? Oh, look, he's got a baby bearded dragon. Actually, it's a cousin of a bearded dragon. This is as big as they get. And oh, whoa. And I'm like, yeah, they eat a tenth of the food of a normal bearded dragon and take up a tenth of the space of a normal bearded dragon. You know, you can have a nice big, you know, enclosure for them, and they go, oh, that's cool. And then they walk away and buy a normal bearded dragon. So I don't know, like, how you get this message across. But yeah, I think people like to keep what other people keep in a lot of ways. And I think it might be a little bit of laziness or risk aversion or something where other people are just good at saying, oh, you know, the ball python or the bearded dragon or the crested gecko are the best pets in the world, and you have to have one or you're, you know, missing out or something like that. And, I mean, I started out breeding bearded dragons, and I had to build like these custom enclosures. You know, I made these elaborate, you know, things and that covered quite a bit of floor space in my herp room, you know, when I started out, and, you know, I really enjoyed them, but yeah, they take a lot of food and a lot of space. And sometimes that's not the best thing for, especially for a new keeper, you know? And I think if people realize that they could be, you know, I guess that's the other side. So that's the next point I'll make is in favor of the larger species, they usually have more eggs, more babies, that kind of thing. And that can be a good thing or a bad thing. I guess if you're looking to sell offspring, then it can be a nice thing to have quite a few babies. And, but also when, species tend to have a lot of eggs or babies, then, you know, the prices also drop pretty quickly on a lot of those projects. And so you have to look for different mutations or different colors or variants or whatever to keep the project alive or keep the, you know, the going rate fairly high. So I guess that can be a double-edged sword, but you know, I remember when I was first starting out and I had, you know, 20, 30 baby bearded dragons and the pet store bought them from me for $50 a piece. You know, that was a nice little payday for a guy who just, you know, spent $200 on a gravid female bearded dragon and then sold the babies a couple months later for $1,000, you know, like, that's not a bad return on investment, you know, but that was back in the day when I looked at that kind of thing, you know, or had that, you know, the dollar signs in my eyes and, oh, this is cool. I can keep reptiles and be a rich, you know, keeper or something when I was naive and dumb back in the day, but. Anyway, yeah, I think that's rambling.
Yeah, like the small species, these smaller species aren't as popular. I think that's like directly because they're small. It's like a bit of happenstance, you know. But there's market issues. And so you have to be creative. Like I think of, Phil, there's only with his Xenogamma. I think of Frank Payne with a lot of the things he's doing, like carpet chameleons.
Yeah.
Some of the lacertas he has are pretty small. A lot of the geckos, even just toad-headed agamas,
Mysticus.
Phrynocephalus, is that right?
Yeah.
I think they're, they're really cool. And then Armin, again, per time with its anoles and microgeckos.
Yeah.
They're having to, besides just name dropping, they are having to create a market. You know, they're doing a lot of effort to educate and to show off these species and market themselves and what they're doing. That you potentially wouldn't have to do if you just had really nice, high quality bearded dragons, panther chameleons, leopard geckos, ball pythons. Mm-hmm.
I think too, in regards to, you know, people who are buying reptiles, a lot of people want to be able to handle them. They don't want to, you know, if they didn't want to handle them, they'd get a fish. Yeah. They just wanted to look at them. And so I think a lot of people aren't going to get a micro gecko or something like that because you can't really handle it very easily or safely for the animal. And so I think that's kind of a big part. People want to interact with their animals. They want to handle them and get them out and show their friends or, you know, watch them eat a rat or a bunny or something. I don't know. Like they want to interact with them that way. And so, that kind of favors the larger species that aren't going to, you know, jump and run, or you can at least kind of restrain it without squishing it, with our primate.
To some extent, that's a function of experience, though, right? So sure. I think that's kind of a when you're getting into it, that's more sort of the mindset. I certainly feel in myself, and I know in a lot of the group, that like you, in general, if you stick with it and all that, the natural tendency is to move the other way and to want to create a system where you can just watch animals do what they would do as naturally as they can, right? Not to say that it's exactly replicating, you know, their natural condition in a box, but I think what you're describing there, that impulse, I couldn't be further away from. I was there at a point today. I couldn't be further away from that.
Yeah. Right. And again, you know, I'm talking beginners who want to get an animal so they can interact with it. And yeah. I think you kind of grow out of that, like Rob said, and that's definitely a good point. But, you might
some degree of your audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now I'm definitely focusing on pretty small species for the most part, but I have my ball python that I've had for, think about both my, the snake's like a year old and my daughter. So the snake's like 9 years old. and I love that. That's a snake I can just let my kids hold.
Yeah.
And I love that snake. Yeah. That I can just pull out and it's easy. I would versus like even my dart frogs don't jump that fast, you know, so they're not like that hard to get a handle on. But like the micro geckos, like the kids cannot touch that door, you know, and they know that they're like, don't go by that one. And so, yeah, like there's a different level there for sure. And I think, as Rob suggests, some of that is because people don't know what they're missing out on if they don't experience watching a gecko truly leap from like branch to branch to branch to branch across an enclosure, because they, you know, it's probably not a behavior like a crested gecko would do, but if you're keeping a crested gecko in like an 18-18-24, it can't do that very well. You know, it can't make those kinds of leaps. Versus you keep one of these tiny geckos or an anole or something, and those are more active. So it's not a directly fair comparison, but you keep those in something half that size, you'll see them make huge jumps like back and forth. And I mean, I'm sitting where I do most of my work during the day, and those geckos are on like a like baker's rack in like the closet, and I'm constantly looking over there because I see tiny little movements out of the side of my eye.
Yeah.
I want all different kinds of aspects of interaction, and watching them is just a pure joy for me. But also holding my ball python, even though I probably do that like once a month, is still something that I'm glad I have. And then like to get, not that I plan to hold my cave gecko often at all, but it's an animal that is slow, that is a little bigger, that I don't have that type of anxiety about compared to the white anacolus. And so, you know, it's smaller than a leopard gecko, but, you know, about that size, you know, but I could pick it up versus the, maybe I could put a couple fruit flies on my finger and try to get them to jump to my finger, you know, is something that I've thought about doing a couple times. I just haven't got around to trying that out. But yeah, you can't have much interaction with the micro gecko.
Other than observing him. And I think there is definitely something to that. You know, I think that's as Rob said, that's kind of something you grow into, and you want to enjoy them more that way rather than handling or taking, you know, the guy with the shirtless guy with the giant python around his neck, walking around the neighborhood. It's kind of, you move further and further from that as you progress in herpetoculture, I think. But, I know that I was there at one point when I was a kid. I had a Burmese python, and I used to walk around the neighborhood, and I think they even had me be in a parade once, because, you know, there's that weird snake kid with the giant snake walking around the neighborhood. Let's give him some attention so he doesn't try to feed it one of our kids to the snake. I don't know. But I'm I'm definitely enjoying the smaller pythons these days versus the Burmese python. And
I agree. Another aspect of that that goes, I mean, directly hand in hand to it is that it's cheaper. So it takes less space. So if you have a smaller house or an apartment, that's easier to provide a nice setup for these animals. It's less electricity. So even if you need to get the same, you know, even if your, you know, desert agamid needs to get to a really high temperature, just like a bearded dragon or an ackee or something, you can do that with a much smaller wattage bulb. So everything it can be scaled down and it's cheaper.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you know, a lot of the bulbs and the fixtures and things like that are geared towards larger cages. And so, you know, you might have a hard, but at the same time, you can run one, you know, tube light over several different cages and kind of make up for it that way, I think.
But. And I'm not going to lie, trying to figure out the 1 gallon grow outs is hard to get a gradient of like 75 to 90 temperature in there was a lot of like, you know, multiple of those little gobies in a 1 gallon enclosure and setting up for a few days and adjusting the heights of the baker's rack to figure it out. That's not like something I would expect a first time keeper to be doing by any means. Right. But now that I have them in, I mean, it's a weird dimension, but it's, I mean, comparable to a smaller Exoterra, that is not hard to heat. You know, I have like a 25 watt halogen on there, just like one of those like tiny like micro bulbs, and so very standard stuff. And then just like the smallest UV bar,
yeah, possible. Yeah, that's I guess the next thing I might hit on is food and food sources. You know, that's somewhat limited. You know, we've got fruit flies or dubia, maybe small enough right at the very first when they're the tiniest little nymph.
Yeah, baby insects.
Yeah, I guess springtails might be good, but do we have many more feeders than that? You know, there's not very many.
At least
that I know of, you know, that's
micro roaches, fire brats, aphids. Not that I have all of those,
are those commercially available? You can,
they're available. So yeah, I would say you need to start culturing them.
Yeah.
So you become an insect keeper along with becoming a reptile keeper.
Yeah.
But maybe not for the adults, you know, for like, you're going to, again, the difference between tiny or small and micro is potentially relevant, right? Like if you're gonna keep a Rankin's or a dragon instead of a bearded dragon, you can go to your pet store and get standard food, right?
Crickets.
Yeah, but you're gonna need, if you're gonna breed them, you're gonna probably need, I don't know, I don't breed Rankin's dragons or Tsimikama, but you're gonna probably need pinheads or something small, right? And they probably, some of them might love fruit flies. And so, yeah, if you're going to breed these animals, it's a definite con that they're absolutely minuscule when they're first born. So that escape risk is way higher, like through mesh.
And also things like really desiccation. Small. Desiccation, yes. and things like that are also a bigger risk when you have a smaller. So I guess the physics of it, or whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Is surface area to volume.
Surface area to volume. The smaller the animal, the more surface area it has and the easier it is to kind of dry out or to have issues that way. And stuck sheds. I mean, I've got some binos geckos in my office at work and I had one that had like kind of a bad shed. And so I tried to help it, you know, and it's really hard to help shed out a small little binos gecko hatchling, compared to an adult binos gecko. And I think I got most of it off, but it still looks like there's maybe some of the toes are stuck. And so you might, you know, it's really a difficult thing. And I tried to soak it, but they don't really like, the water doesn't soak into such a small area. You know, a drop of water is about as big as its whole arm or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of a tricky thing to do.
Yeah. Let alone trying to take it to a vet for, care or getting meds out of it to make something that you can give orally. I follow, I should look up. We'll keep talking and I'll find it. But it's a hurt vet that he recently did an endoscopy on a leopard gecko that had like a fecal lip, like an impacted stool burden. That is able to clear out with endoscopy. I mean, there's no way you're doing, then that's impressive in and of itself, right? Yeah. But there's no way you're doing an endoscopy on a micro gecko, or like the alternatives I think of to like, you know, leopard gecko, which I would say is not a big animal, but you know, you could get Stenodactylus, you could get Paradura, like the ocelot ground geckos, you could get viper geckos,
Yeah, those viper gecko hatchlings are pretty tiny too.
Yeah, but like as an adult, if you get a subadult or adult viper gecko, that will eat crickets easy. Same with Stenodactylus, mealworms or crickets. But the babies won't. The babies need fruit flies or pinheads, you know, something very specific. Or like something really small, I guess Stenodactylus are really small, but Tropiocolodes, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but like, you know, like really tiny sand geckos. There's no way you might not even be able to catch them out of their enclosure, let alone get adequate, you know, vet care in that same way that you could for a larger animal.
For sure. Yeah, there's that's the challenge I had, I think, with some of these small geckos is once something goes wrong, you're kind of in trouble, you know. And this the one that had the shed issues, the albino's gecko, he's still kicking, he's still doing all right. And actually, when I was trying to help him shed out, his tail fell off, and so he's having to regrow his tail and overcome the other issues. But he's like half the size of his siblings that hatched out around the same time, and it just kind of continual struggle. And I just feel bad. Like, I feel like, you know, part of it's my responsibility. And I think it was just a period of cold where I didn't have the heat, like the bulb burned out and I didn't replace it quick enough. And it was like at the wrong time when he was shedding. That one was shedding, because they're all females. But that was just kind of the bad timing, you know, bad luck type thing. But you know, those kind of
smaller margin there for those tiny
exactly. That's kind of the bigger challenge, is the small margin of error that you have with those species. But also, you know, smaller species typically tend to be more fecund and maybe breed at a smaller or younger age, smaller size. You know, they produce fairly rapidly because they're kind of more like
one or two eggs insects. At a time.
Yeah, exactly.
But like several, like anoles. Yeah.
Yeah. They just
keep like an egg a week or whatever.
Eggs. Yep. Exactly. So they've developed these strategies to overcome that small size. When you're food for everybody, you know, you got to make a lot of yourself just to counteract that. And so, yeah, they're maybe a little easier to, now I'm getting into your side, I guess, giving points to you, but, you know, that they're maybe a little easier to breed. And so you may lose some, but you have more chances to get it right or to figure it out and to eventually do well with all the babies, hopefully. I guess that's the goal. But the challenge is to, you know, you're going to feel bad because you're probably going to lose some of the babies to silly things like, or stupid things like that.
Shout out to Hurt Vet Harris. So Clement, that's the Instagram account I was talking about, that guy that did the endoscopy on the leopard gecko. He is like, they're a remarkable account. If you haven't seen him, you should check him out.
He said
Hurt Vet Paris. So Clement, and I'm not going to try to say his last name, he's French, is in Paris. But really amazing stuff that he posts.
That's cool.
Some of it's pretty tragic, but like the interventions that he's doing are really cool. I learned a lot by seeing that.
That's cool.
Yeah. Another thing that is of particular interest to me and is not intrinsic to, it's not, you can take it or leave it. You know, you can see it as a pro or a con potentially, but I see it as a pro is the ability to, if you're in this plays into a previous debate you've had recently of whether or not cohabbing is okay. If you're going to ever cohab, you want to do it with lots of space and lots of complexity. And so going smaller species is potentially the best way to optimize that. You think about if you're going to say the reasonable minimum for something is 20 gallons or 40 gallons or something, you probably don't want to double that for two species. You probably want to triple or quadruple that to be able to give the adequate amount of complexity. So if you have a tiny micro gecko or a knoll or something where you're saying the minimum is a few gallons, now all of a sudden you can, make a 60, 100, 200 gallon closure, custom closure or something, and you could make an awesome environment with multiple of the animals, or potentially even a mixed habitat, because a lot of these animals aren't, apex predators, and they're small, and so you could, potentially mix a gecko with a tree frog, or, that type of thing. I'm not saying, again, that that's a beginner thing, and people should go back and listen to your awesome cohabiting episode, because I think you touch on all the appropriate points. But if you're going to do it, I think these micro animals are small or micro animals are the some of the prime candidates for it.
Yeah. You want to pull that microphone a little closer again?
Sorry.
There we go.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's better. I
hopefully people heard this. My great arguments.
Yeah, no, I think we did, but it was just getting a little bit to the muffled side. But I saw a cool exhibit at the National Zoo. It had the the Madagascan leaf-tailed geckos and a Felsuma species. I think it was Clemerae.
I was there last year, and exhibit was awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty fun because the, of course, the leaf-tail geckos are just kind of sitting there motionless because they're nocturnal, and whereas the Felsuma are diurnal, so you see them running around and climbing and stuff, and they're brightly colored and fun to watch. So you kind of get the best of both worlds when you have.
And it was it's a bigger leaf-tail gecko too, right? It's a Sakurai or something.
Yeah,
right.
Yep, one of the larger species.
Yeah.
Filled up, most of the bamboo length, their body length. So yeah, it's pretty cool. But that was fun to see, I guess I was with some of my coworkers who are not reptile people, and they're like, don't the big ones eat the little ones? I'm like, they're not looking at them as food. I don't think so.
Yeah. And if you really mix match the size big enough, you make a big enclosure for like a bigger snake, and then you put a tiny little frog or something in there that the snake's not, Corallus and dark frogs, it happens all the time. So you can make it like a biotope type situation. An adult Corallus is going to not, tree boas are not going to get a frog or a lizard. They're going to look for warm-blooded avian or mammals. So that's a fairly safe cohab to do. So you make a big enclosure for your snake, and then fitting in a few dart frogs is like a bonus.
Yeah, for sure. I had a friend that bred dart frogs for a long time. Then he kind of moved over towards green tree pythons and got a bunch of those. And he had a picky feeder neonate green tree. And so he thought, maybe he'll take a dart frog. And so he put a few, smaller frogs in there that would be a meal size for the baby or the hatchling green tree. and paid no attention to them, had no interest in the frogs. Yeah. And I mean, obviously they're from different continents and maybe that played a part in it, but, yeah, they didn't recognize that kind of frog movement and shape as food potentially. Yeah. And there's not, I don't know that there's many records of frogs in green, none that I could find where.
Yeah. You know, I don't know green tree, green tree pythons. I'm interested in making like a big, like choco, mixed species, habitat. This is years down the line and want to experiment with all these animals individually, but like potentially, you know, Phyllobates terribilis, orange black with the dark rod, and then some glass frogs that would you know, be higher up in the vivarium, and then like an annulated tree boa. Yeah. Or if I wanted to break the biotope, I could go for like a more easy to acquire Amazon tree boa. Yeah. And so looking at their dietary preferences, and there's not much available for annulated ones, but for Amazons. Yeah, they, as babies, will eat like anoles and tree frogs, but I haven't found anything about it being dark frogs, but potentially tree frogs. And then, but once they get bigger, it's like exclusively birds, bats, rodents.
Yeah. Yeah. They did have a display in the Henry Dorley Zoo in, is that in Wichita? No, where is that?
Omaha,
yeah. And they had green tree pythons, but they had the Kimberley splendid tree frogs in there with them, which are, you know, they're not from the same area, but they're, it was a cool kind of mixed species display. And when we were there, there was a Kimberley tree frog sitting right on top of the green tree python. Kind of, I think it was in, they had it in kind of a nocturnal setup. So you see them, you know, and then. So they're active and moving around, but that's pretty cool.
No, I've definitely seen, I forget where it was, but they had, I think it was just like a boa constrictor. It was some type of more land dwelling that, I think it was a bushmaster or a viper. I'm not sure, but it was something, it was a South American enclosure and they had, poison frogs in there, and the poison frogs were like jumping across the length of the animal, and it was terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. That would be a fun kind of mixed species with the very large and very small in the same space. But yeah,
I think at Denver Zoo they had something like that with dart frogs in with the bushmasters.
Cool.
Yeah. That actually sounds familiar. Yeah, like, certainly they have big bushmasters, and I think there were. Yeah, whether I'm trying to tanks or something in there with them.
Cool.
Yeah. I think the caution there is just make sure you get stuff from the same area. I guess you don't have to, but you know, I guess it's always nicer when it's well thought out. You got the right plants and the right species, the, you know, that would be found sympatrically in the same environment.
There's a lot of dart frogs with Belsuma in, you know, going on. Yeah. It works. Like it works fine. You know, as long as it's big enough that you can get it hot on the top, because the dart frogs don't want that warm. But if you make it vertically oriented so the Belsuma have a good place, and that even separates them a little bit. But yeah, the Madagascar and South America mixture does makes me feel a certain way that I'm not sure is you know, people can do what they want to do. So I think it's fine. The animals are well taken care of and the animals are fine. But it does make me go a little bit. But
I think one of my favorite exhibits at the local zoo, the Hogle Zoo in Salt Lake, they had a big desert enclosure. I mean, it was an open air, so it was just like a wall. And then they had like chuckwallas and spiny lizards and leopard, you know, all collared lizards, I think, were in there. And then they had free flying birds in there. So they had like a cardinal and, you know, some other brightly colored birds and a desert tortoise and stuff like that. It was really a cool mixed species, naturalistic type set. They had big you know, rock boulders and cliff faces where the animals could climb around. It was really a cool display, but it kind of went downhill. And now I think there's just like a desert tortoise and a chuck wall in there or something.
So. If you don't want to dedicate a whole room to it, but instead just like 6 foot by 2 feet by 3 feet or something, you could have smaller animals and have that in your room.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's the beauty of the small things. Well, that'd be a fun project to find a bunch of overlapping species and, you know, set them up and all together. Guess you could do that fairly easily. And a lot of those are
on my bucket list.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, any other burning thoughts or topics that we didn't cover yet?
Rob? I got through mine. I'm looking at I had a list of animals that I think would be fun alternatives. Oh, we didn't talk about salamanders, but I think salamanders are underrepresented and some of them are so small. So I think they would be a cool animal for people to keep. And then Eurodactyloides, the chameleon geckos, those should be as popular as the crested geckos, I think. I mean, they don't have the colors. They don't have quite that, like, characteristic look with, like, that head shape. But they're so cool, and they're easy to keep, and they're not, like, super fast the way a lot of the other really small geckos are. And they're from that exact same area. I mean, I think, like crested geckos, they benefit from insects, but people keep them on just powder dye. Really small chameleons too.
Those Eurodactyloides have some great patterns too.
That like surprisingly large scalation for how little they are is pretty remarkable. Almost makes them look reticulated or netted.
Yeah, netted pattern looks really cool. Almost like a mini parenti or something.
they're cool. And they move so deliberately, like almost chameleon-like.
Yeah. I guess that's where they get their common name, chameleon gecko. But they're fun looking. So
More people should have them. And judging by the last Tinley that I went to, they are, you know, pretty popular. Like more people are finding them on the table.
Yeah, for sure.
And then lots of really cool small chameleons too that I think are really interesting. Like carpet chameleons are definitely on the rise and really popular. But then also like Rickettsia and some Collina species that are, you know, some of them are big, but some of them can be really small, really capable compared to. I mean, panda chameleons, I think people can take care of them perfectly fine. I'm not concerned about their, you know, people being able to take care of them in a normal size enclosure in a normal sized room, but they're big lizards. Or at least, you know, medium sized lizards.
I think too, once we kind of get that the more appropriate care for chameleon species, including, you know, fogging to give them their moisture and their liquid, and also, you know, the maybe solid enclosures anywhere but Florida, you know, that kind of idea of keeping them better. I think Frank Payne is doing a great job at kind of revolutionizing or bringing the market to the animal rather than, you know, trying to fit the square peg in a round hole or whatever. But
And I think Bill with Chameleon Academy did some cool stuff with that. He has big and small chameleons. There's another account, Tiny Dragons. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. Tiny Tree Dragons. I've had a great time getting to know him online. And he does a lot of Rickettsia, but he has other small species too. And so just like these, the tiniest of little chameleons. They're so cool to see. Really tempting.
Have we had a very good track record with the Brookesia? It seems like a lot of Brookesia are imported, but nobody's very successful with them. Are people doing all right with them? I don't
know. I mean, I think now that people have a general understanding, I don't keep them, so big caveat there. But I think people, after we kind of learned about their natural history and how to actually like have a successful strategy and having the right equipment, I think people are being successful. But I think the problem is the interest in the market aspect of it. They have like, you know, pretty short lifespans, and they have that like, you know, the insect of the reptile world, kind of mentality of like breeding really fast. Some of these, I'm not sure if it's Rickettsia or a different type of small chameleon, where their natural history in the wild is that they essentially go extinct every year, where they, you know, the adults all don't make it through the seasons, and it's their eggs in the ground that become the next generation.
Right, it's cicada chameleons, basically.
Yeah,
for the most part, or for 90% of them, or whatever.
And so, so there's some aspect of that, but I think some of the bigger Rickettsia, Helii, Supsiliatus, I think, if I remember correctly, are fairly well established. Like, people are breeding them. You can definitely get captive bred ones. But I think there, if you go up through like chameleon forums, you can find the list of people that are like, oh, I used to have this, and they, none of them get close to establish.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, hopefully the more we learn, the better we'll do with some of these species. And
And I do think that's true. Like a decade or two ago, like keeping really small things wasn't, we didn't have the equipment to do it appropriately.
Right. But I do think we do wasn't now. There in the same way.
I think we do have that now. Like, we have the ability to find out their natural history. We have the access to that type of knowledge. We have, for not everything, but for a lot of things. And now we have the type of equipment that we can make small enclosures for the babies, and can, now's the time to do it.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think you had some really, really good points that are hard to argue with, for sure. But, you know, there's definitely some fun to be had with larger species. But I think more and more, and I mean, where it's increasingly difficult to afford a house. And so people might be, you know, we might see more people living in apartments and condos or whatever, and they're not going to have the room to have a dedicated herp room or things like that. So, you know, keeping smaller species in more limited space, will allow you to be able to enjoy a reptile in the space that you have. And so, and I think European keepers definitely are well onto that and well ahead of us in that regard. And, maybe just because they've been forced to consider that, but, and I think they appreciate a wider range, or at least used to. I hope they still do, because, Americans are kind of monoculture mindset a lot of times, you know, kind of follow the trends, but I like the idea of having a large diversity of cool species, because there's just so many cool reptiles out there. And if we can establish more and more and give people different options, and they can learn about other cool species that are available in the hobby, I think that's where the fun comes, you know?
Yeah. And I think you, I'm looking at my list of cons in case I got stuck with the other side of the argument, and you really hit them all. The obscure animals without established markets, hard to handle, escape, tiny food, more sensitive, especially the babies, and hard to breed. So there's some hurdles, but I think, again, if you shift smaller instead of micro, a lot of those hurdles are easier.
Yeah, great discussion. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that on and fighting the good fight. You presented your side very well. So, any cool herpetological discoveries or observations you guys have seen over the last week or two? I haven't really been focused on anything other than my presentations to the NIH, and so I've been kind of preoccupied with that,
anything? I was looking at the International Herpetological Symposium coming up in June, and saw some cool name on there of yours. Is that accurate?
What's that? Of
saw your name on there.
Oh, you did. Oh, from the IHS. That's yeah. Cool. Is it? It's probably some collaborative work I did with on snake viruses, maybe. Or
oh,
is
are you? You're not presenting.
I hadn't. I wasn't able to go this year, but they oh. did, they did okay. approach me to go. So did they okay. put my name up? Uh oh.
Yeah, your name's on the website.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They'd approach me. I just don't have enough time off right now. And
you can cut this out if you want.
Yeah. No, sorry. It's fine. I that's interesting to learn.
Okay. Yeah.
I felt bad. I couldn't make it, but yeah, I would have
been that is a bummer.
Presenting there.
Yeah. I'm going and talking at that.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Yeah. So it should be fun. That,
yeah.
But yeah, I was hoping to get to see you again there. But
yeah, shoot.
Yeah. Okay. That was my one announcement. And Roy Blodgett told me to rep it as much as we could. But cool. So I was under assumption that you were also coming. So
when is it again?
End of June.
Yeah.
Like the 20th, something like that.
Okay.
21st.
That's right. Yeah. I feel really bad. I wasn't able to make it, but yeah, you'll have to represent what are you speaking on?
I wrote a paper that I'm still trying to get published on trying to define at least a philosophical concept of a minimum care standard for animals.
Cool. Yeah. So that's the philosophy we'll I was talking about earlier that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Hearing yeah. about. So yeah.
That's so it's not like an objective scale that you can like grade yourself or something, but like, you know, how do we conceptualize a minimum care standard?
Yeah.
You know, after it gets published, hopefully, and presented and stuff, we could argue about it.
Yeah. Cool. And where have you submitted it yet? Or are you
looking yes. for
options? Yeah. Okay.
So I have a master's in bioethics and health policy. Yeah. And so I did a little bit of animal welfare in the context of like lab animals for the most part. And so I have some background in the very, like very basics, but have read up about it quite a bit more in the context of exotic animal keeping in the last couple of years. And so, and potentially moving a little bit more academically in that way as like a little bit of an academic side hustle. So yeah, I don't know the animal ethics and animal welfare branch very well. And there's a big division between the people that are, you know, animal rights based and animal welfare focused. And so I've mislanded a few, trying to go, some of the bigger, higher impact journals are that more animal rights focus. And my argument is definitely a welfare utility argument. And so they didn't appreciate it very much. So I'm on try three right now. Hopefully it's a better. I don't want to necessarily name drop things that are still pending, but hopefully try three will work.
Yeah. No, that's cool. The other one that's that I was hoping to make was the biology of the lizards. I guess it's biology of the lizards 2 conference in Rodeo, Bob Ashley's place.
Yeah.
Steve Sharp is speaking at that, and so he invited me to go out, and you know, he said I've got a place to stay, and you know, I could pick you up from the airport and that kind of thing, but my parents decided to book a cruise and take all me and my siblings and our spouses. And so I'm going to be in the Caribbean at the time. So
yeah.
I was like, yeah, cause it was kind of when we were trying to plan the trip and it was very difficult to get everybody's schedules aligned. And so I was like, there might be a chance we're not going to do the cruise, but then they went through with it. And so we booked it. So I had to tell Steve, sorry, but that looks cool too. That's in, July 24th through 27th there in a great spot for herping. I mean, and it's probably during the monsoons, depending on the year, I guess the monsoons are becoming less.
Right, maybe a little early, but we'll see.
Yeah. So July 24th to 27th in the Chiricahua Desert Museum in Rodeo. So yeah, that should be awesome. A cool thing. I know Steve's speaking on his work with the blunt-nosed leopard lizards, which are, you know, endangered in California, and not to be confused with the leopard gecko. These are leopard lizards.
Yeah,
that was a mistake made on the website for the conference. And he's like, it looks good, except I'm not talking on leopard geckos. I'm talking on leopard lizards. Kind of funny. But yeah, lizards are cool. So I wouldn't mind attending that for sure. But unfortunately, not this year.
Yeah.
Cool lizard thing lately was the Animals at Home podcast. Talked to a German breeder of Phrynosoma, who basically his entire obsession is with horned lizards, and that episode was really good. Just hearing, I mean, talk about unsurprisingly a German guy, you know, who just said, I'm going to make it work with horned lizards from the time he's 17, 18, whatever, and just the level of commitment, what he's doing, and how he's continually tweaking and all this stuff, but having success. Really cool episode, the couple cool snake talks, my buddy Dustin Smith was on there talking about Virgin Island boas and a variety of his career and stuff. Maybe we'll get him to come on to fight. Maybe we'll have him on boas. NPR, we'll figure something out. I'd reached out to him and said, oh, you know, here you go. You go on this. You won't come on mine. And it's like, well, that's not really fair since I haven't asked yet. But, you know, nevertheless. And then he talked to Dr. Harry Green. He just talked about Ashley again, about the snake bite treatment book, you know, all that stuff. So, those have been really good. And the Snakes and Stogies 200 was really fun. Yeah, for That's sure. Awesome. So,
yeah. Who was, so Harry Green's, one of his former grad students, or I think she did a graduate work in his lab, but, she mentioned him. She was on a California, magazine doing an interview on rattlesnakes, and she had some pretty
Cool.
Yeah. What's now? I shouldn't have mentioned it without remembering her name. But
always names. It's always a problem for you.
It's always a problem for me. I'm getting old. but yeah, she did a really great job there. I think it was Lucas. I can remember his name barely. But I think he alerted us.
Yeah, the person that I know who you're talking about. Unfortunately, I can't help you, but I do follow her on Instagram, and right, she just wrote a book on California snakes.
Yeah,
it's the same person. Yeah, definitely a ton of cool research that she's putting out there.
Yeah. Oh man, I apologize for not remembering that name, but anyway, yeah, it was some cool talk on rattlesnakes, and that's always kind of a hard thing, is to sell the public on the shy and, you know, non-confrontational nature of the rattlesnake. You know, what was it? Somebody said that their rattle was more like they're screaming, you know, out of fear rather than, you know, an aggressive, I'm going to get you rattle. You know, it's like, leave me alone. Don't hurt me. I'm just hanging out here. You know, I don't know. Kind of cool.
I was talking to a coworker who had gone on a vacation down in Arizona and described like going on a run. And then I don't remember if they saw a rattlesnake or someone else saw a rattlesnake and described it on the path. Like, oh, I'm never running on that path again. I had the rest of the vacation went a different way. It's like, think about how many you ran past and never saw. And it was like, they hadn't even considered that aspect of it. And like, they had like some like terror in their eyes. I was like, that's their nature. They want to hide. Like they don't. They're not trying to bite you. They're not trying to rattle you. They're just trying to exist without bothering you because they're scared of you. And she, I don't think I completely convinced her, but I made her terrified. I think to go back to Arizona. I was like, you ran by probably 10 that you didn't see.
Yeah. Yeah. For every one you see. Yeah. There's probably at least that many that you didn't see. And even when you're, I mean, specifically out there looking for them, you still miss a lot. And, you know, luckily they do rattle, and that's kind of, I love that sound because it means we just found one. You know, that was kind of the thrill of that sound, is I just sit and wait for that, you know, to hear it. Yep. And when you don't hear it, you just kind of get bummed out. At least strange people like us.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, yeah, I really appreciate you coming on again, Billy. This has been a lot of fun. So
yeah, it's great. I love it.
Good, good luck with your publication and your talk at the IHS. And I'm sad that I won't make it, but sure you'll do a great job out there. But we'll thank Morelia Python Radio for hosting us and for all that they do. And go check out all their stuff on social media. And we'll catch you again next time for Reptile Fight Club. See ya.